At Sleep Outfitters Outlet, great sleep is a big deal. Save 40 to 60% every day on every Sealy, Stearns & Foster, and Tempur-Pedic. Queens as low as $249. Customer exchanges, closeouts, and floor samples. Inventory changes daily, so come in for your dream deal today. With no credit needed financing, expert advice, and up to 60% off retail, it's never been easier to get the sleep and savings you deserve. Go to sleepoutfittersoutlet.com for financing details and to find a store near you.
Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get three-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back. Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. The last podcast of November, Beck. First full month of the season is officially in the books. Does it feel like it's been a full month, or does it feel longer?
It feels like we've been at this for 3 months already because everything that could have possibly gone weird or sideways or bizarre or just wrong with the NBA has in the last like 6 weeks. We don't need to go through it all, but my God, there's been a lot of just bizarreness, drama, all the usual stuff packed in the last 6 weeks. More important question, how was your Thanksgiving pastrami sandwich?
It was excellent. It was everything I could have asked for and more. And I noticed on Twitter, Beck, that you were perturbed at the number of people that were siding with me. Like, you thought it'd be poll up there. You thought it'd be a landslide in favor of your traditional turkey and stuffing and all that crap that boring people eat. you thought there would be more people supporting you, but more surprisingly, plenty supported me.
It got off to a troubling start. I had a narrow lead. There was a narrow lead in favor of turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes, all the usual stuff versus your ridiculous Thanksgiving pastrami sandwich. It was disturbingly close initially. I just will note that after the people spoke, 1,029 of them, it's a decent sample size, final tally 61.4% for the traditional Thanksgiving meal in favor of, therefore, me, 38.6% in favor of you and your pastrami sandwich, so better luck next time.
But they're lying. Like, your people are lying. Like, if they had the opportunity to sit down and eat Domino's pizza or whatever, they would have done
Domino's.
I just don't believe that if given a alternative, people would choose turkey stuffing, cranberry sauce, all that. I just don't believe it. I'll go to my grave never believing that.
Let me just say, I don't know what the other alternatives would be, but any poll in which somebody chose Domino's pizza over almost anything would be incredibly. Domino's is freaking terrible.
No, You're dead wrong. I'm in Boston right now.
You're never allowed back in New York, by the way.
I ordered Domino's pizza for lunch yesterday. Recording this on Monday. I recorded on lunch on Sunday, and then when I got home, I polished off what was left of the pizza after Celtics Wizards on Sunday night. So,
and in the process, you have now polished off whatever respect was left for you as an arbiter of what good food can be, because whatever. The pastrami sandwich on Thanksgiving, I was willing to accept as kind of a counter-narrative, a counter-culture thing. You're going your own way. You're an individual. Pastrami's good. That's fine. Domino's pizza does not belong in any discussion of quality food on this planet. So, and negates all of your New York rights. Like, you just cannot come to this city like sitting there pontificating about the greatness of Domino's pizza. You can't.
Shout out to Domino's. If you want to sponsor the podcast, give us a shout. I will be supporting. You just pay me in pizza. I'm cool with that. All right, Howard, I want to get into a few topics today. We're going to get into the first quarter MVP debate, which is kind of interesting because I think there's four or five really good candidates right now. I want to get into the Clippers. How concerned should the Clippers be at this point because of the injury issue specifically to Kawhi Leonard? And in the latest installment of Is This Sustainable?, I want to get into the Indiana Pacers, who are off to one of the better starts in the NBA, 11-8 on the season. I want to talk about their ability to kind of hang on and stay in the playoff mix. But Howard, because it is a day that ends in Y, we got to talk about the Lakers, who have won five of their last six games. Granted, three of those wins have come against the lowly San Antonio Spurs, who have dropped back down to earth after a decent start. If the Lakers could play the Spurs, you know, twice a week, they'd probably be a finals contender, but they are about to enter the teeth of their schedule in the next month. But look, you play the teams that are put in front of you. The Lakers have been beating those teams. The Pistons were on that list as well. Have you seen anything from the Lakers that makes you believe they're onto something, or is this just one of those weird quirks in the schedule that enables them to beat up on the inferior opponents?
You know, the NBA could not have known in August when they constructed the schedule about how big of a favor they were doing the Lakers, but they did the Lakers an incredibly large favor. And they could have known this much. The NBA certainly knew that the San Antonio Spurs were not planning to be a good team this year. They just couldn't have anticipated that the Lakers would need the Spurs as badly as the Lakers needed the Spurs. Yeah, they've won five of their last six and three of their last four, but the three of their last four are Spurs, 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 with a loss to Phoenix mixed in. The Spurs are terrible. The Spurs have won like a have lost like a bazillion games this month. I think the Spurs have one win since October 30th, if I recall correctly, something like that. Like the Spurs are about as bad as you can get in the NBA right now. So that the Lakers have fattened up recently on, look, and there's some legit stuff here, right? Anthony Davis playing like a star again, looking like a actually vital, important player in the league again, is very encouraging for the Lakers. Westbrook's been off and on, whatever, in the sixth man role. It's fine, whatever. I'm not too excited about that. There's not. And then LeBron's back, and LeBron looks like LeBron. Okay, fine. Great. But I cannot put any stock in this five out of six when three of those wins are against the Spurs. One is against the Pistons, who are, again, a bottom three team. And one was against the Nets, who, A, haven't been very good overall, and, B, were still without both Ben Simmons and Kyrie Irving in that game. So, no, I am not nearly sold on the idea that this is some indication of a Lakers revival. It's a respite, and that's about all I can say.
Yeah, wake me up in a few weeks, and if the Lakers are playing above 500 basketball when we get closer to Christmas, then I'll be sold.
By the way, they won't be. Should we go through the schedule?
I was just about to do that. I mean, Monday night, a lot of people listening to this podcast, this game will already happen. The Buddy Hield, Miles Turner Bowl in L.A. with Indiana in town. Pacers, as we mentioned, playing well. Then there's a home game against Portland. Then there is a six-game road trip that takes the Lakers through Milwaukee, Washington, Cleveland, Toronto, Philadelphia, and Detroit. One, two, three, yeah, six. That could easily be a 1-5 road trip. Easily. You know, Washington, they got pummeled by Boston on Sunday night, but they've been playing good basketball. Detroit's probably the only game that looks like a gimme, but that's the last game of that road trip, so they got some problems there. Then they're home with Boston, Denver, and the Wizards again. Then they're back on the road against Phoenix. So this is a tough month for the Lakers. December coming up is a very tough month. If they can get through these next, you know, 10, 12 games with an above 500 record, we might have a different conversation. But at this point, they're playing the Spurs is what they've been doing, and that's enabled them to get to where they are right now.
And gave up 138 points to the Spurs.
It's a wild game.
In the third of their three wins. beat them by five. Like, it's not like there's nothing particularly impressive other than the win total. And as soon as you start to drill down, I think it gets very flimsy. And yes, we will learn a lot about them over the next couple of weeks. And I think what we will learn is they're probably every bit as bad as they looked in their, whatever, 2-10 start, 2-8 start, 2-10 start. Maybe they're not quite as bad as 2-10, but they're not They're not that much better than that. And we're going to see that. They'll be exposed on this road trip, I'm fairly certain. And that's not an indictment of LeBron, who, when he's playing, and he just got back from injury, missed whatever, six games. LeBron's still great. Anthony Davis, when healthy, obviously still capable of great things. Westbrook is Westbrook at this stage, and the rest of the roster is a bunch of guys who would barely make a rotation of most of the contenders. So,
yeah, it's the same problems they had at the start of the season. They just were glossed over by the inferiority of the schedule at this point. All right, there's your obligatory Lakers reference at the top of the show. All right, I want to talk about the MVP race right now because we're right around the quarter point of the season. You're starting to see some of the top contenders separate a little bit. We're kind of getting a bit of a top five-ish look from teams. If you look at the NBA.com MVP ladder, one of my favorite things to look at most weeks, you've got Luka Doncic hanging out there at the top, Nikola Jokic hanging out there at the top, Giannis Antetokounmpo hanging out there at the top, and my guy, Jason Tatum, who I picked to win MVP this year, he is in that mix as well. Let's start here, Howard. You, at the quarter point of the season, who would be your first quarter MVP?
So I was using as my kind of basis or just guideline initial pool the Basketball Reference MVP award tracker, because what they do is they do a probability based on all the past results. So it takes into account the team's record, stats, everything, puts it into a formula and says, this is who's most likely based on past results of MVP. Your guy, Jason Tatum, is in fact at the top of that list with a 22.7% chance, according to Basketball Reference's algorithm. Jokic is very close behind him at 22.1%. So just, you know, tenths of a percentage point there. Then they go Doncic, Giannis, Curry, and then drops down a little bit to get to Donovan Mitchell. So that's the group, according to the Basketball Reference Award Tracker, using formula and based on past results. Within that, so it's interesting to kind of look at the those respective cases. And to answer your question, I think I'm leaning Curry right now, even though, as you know, I'm all about, like, the team's got to be a clear contender. They got to have a good record.
Let's just pause on that one a second there. Like, you have sang an aria the last couple of years about how winning matters, right? Being on a top two or three team matters. You're going to lean towards Steph Curry right now. The Warriors could be great by the end of the season, but right now they are the definition of average at this moment.
Well, all right, so let me just, because I knew eventually I would have to explain this, but you decided to jump in first.
I did, because I'm rude.
Which is fine. I jumped all over you for, you know, your awful Domino's reference. So we're at the quarter point of the season. When we get to March and April and we're having a serious MVP discussion, there's no question in my mind that if the Warriors are still hovering around 500 and are a fringe playoff team, I'm not going to put Steph Curry high on my ballot if he makes it at all. Maybe he'd make fourth or fifth or whatever. That's the way I usually do this thing. If you're going to make the top spot, you've got to be on a clear contender, a top two or three team in one of the conferences. You should be a 50-plus win team. That is decades and decades of precedent with, you know, a few exceptions. At this early stage of the season, as we're discussing this on November 28th, I'm going to make some exceptions to my usual rules because why not? It's only November 28th, and who gives a shit? This has no bearing on what goes on my ballot, the real one, in this spring. It has no bearing on my own standards for this. It's just kind of like, you know what? At this stage of the season, this is where I think my head is. Part of this is the dreaded narrative. I know people hate the narrative. The Warriors, despite being the defending champs, of course, have had to overcome quite a bit of just malaise and internal strife and all kinds of weird shit. And in the midst of all of that, Steph Curry is having, like, playing some of the best basketball of his entire career and single-handedly keeping them plausibly in the race here. And if the question will eventually be, well, could Curry be MVP? Based on the idea that the Warriors have to be a plausible contender under my usual standard. Yeah, like as of right now, I still think they're a plausible contender. Like they're three games out of first. Despite everything, they're three games out of first. They do have a winning record. I'm not going to consider anybody with a losing record. And yeah, they're one game over 500. But they have a winning record. They're three games out of first. They're two games behind the second place Denver Nuggets. The West is weird this year. That's part of it. But they're fine. He's been outstanding. Absolutely outstanding, mind-bogglingly great. He's on pace. Like, if you resort that group of guys who were at the top of the MVP tracker on Basketball Reference, sort them by effective field goal percentage, Steph's at .648. It's like insane. .648 effective field goal percentage. The only one close is Jokic at .643. Your guy Tatum is down at .556, which is perfectly respectable. But Steph is like running laps around people when it comes to scoring at an incredibly high efficiency. And obviously he's one of the top scorers in the league right now at 31.4 points. I think his assists at 7 assists a game, I think, might be the second highest of his career. He's averaging almost 7 rebounds a game. He's been incredible. He's been absolutely incredible.
No, he has. And it takes nothing away from his play to for me to say I wouldn't vote for him. But if we're going to use a criteria that we use at the end of the season, at least one that I use, which is team results matter, I can't put Steph at the top of my list. In the same way, I can't put Luka at the top of my list, who is also clobbering people with the way he's playing. Just outrageous numbers at the moment. I got to give it to Tatum right now. The Celtics, who we're going to get into in a couple of minutes, they have the NBA's best record. Tatum's averaging more than 30 points per game. I think he's like 6th in the league in scoring, a weird start to the season with his 6-7 guys with averaging 30 more points per game. He's improved from last year. Some of the notable improvements have been his free throw shooting. He's shooting a career best, I think 8-9 free throws per game. His percentage of points on free throws right now is 25%. That's the career high. And the first time he's ever been above 20% with percentage of points. And, you know, he's not the only reason that the Celtics are where they are right now, but he is the biggest reason that they're where they are right now, because he's the best player on a really, really, really good team. So there's a lot of analytics you can get into when it gets really, really close. And we kind of did that last year with Embiid and Jokic and kind of how they were going back and forth. But right now, I look at the team with the best record, a team, the player who's the best player, who's putting up monster numbers for that team. And it just makes me want to lean more towards them at this point. So right now, Jason Tatum is my MVP.
And let me be clear, like, if we were to project forward, if this weren't, you know, hey, who's our first quarter of the season MVP? If this were, let's do the exercise as project this out, multiply everything by 4, the records, the stats, everything. And these are their final stats of the season, their final averages and efficiency numbers of the season, and project out the wins based on their win percentages right now. I'll say it's a 2-way race, and it's Tatum versus Giannis. Like, those are the two best teams, and both guys have been absolutely dominant. And, you know, is this leaning hard into the best player on best team model? Yeah, I mean, I kind of use that as a little bit of a starting point. It's not all, you know, it's not all controlling, but ideally the MVP should be a guy who's doing really great things on a really great team. The two best teams are the Bucks and the Celtics at this stage of the season. No question. I don't even think there's an argument there. And it's not just that Tatum and Giannis are the two best guys on those teams. It's that they've also put up outstanding statistics, outstanding production, have led their teams on both sides of the ball as well. So if we were just doing this as a project it forward, and this is where we stand on April 1st, I'm sitting here trying to drill down on Tatum versus Giannis and trying to figure out who's got the edge on one of the advanced stats, on, off, whatever it may be. You start to factor in other things that have happened over the course of the season and how they responded in tougher moments, all that stuff. So that's where I would be if this were April 1st. But it's November 28th, and I'm going to just do whatever I want.
Now, look, Steph Curry can get right back to the top of my ballot, at least, because the Warriors are starting to trend in the right direction. Klay Thompson is getting his game together. They're just bludgeoning teams offensively right now. So I think if they get back into the mix in that top three in the Western Conference, which is more likely than not, given their roster, he's going to make a strong case for himself. But right now, best player on the best team, putting up big numbers, I lean towards Jason Tatum. Let's use that as a way to transition to the Celtics, who are an NBA best, I said, 16-4 after beating the Wizards. They're a team that made the finals last season behind the NBA's best defense, but they're winning this season with an absolutely dominant offense, like a historically great offense. Howard, these offensive numbers that the Celtics are putting up are just bonkers. They have the best offensive rating. They have the best net rating. They have the highest effective field goal percentage in the NBA. Tatum, who we just talked about, is top five MVP right now. Brown, Jaylen Brown, is making his case to be an all-NBA player, not just an all-star this year. Marcus Smart, he's averaging a career-best 7 assists per game. Al Horford is shooting 48% from three. Al Horford is shooting 48% from three. You got Brogdon playing well. Sam Hauser, who I've got a column up on SI.com right now, he is like statistically the best player in the NBA. If you want to look at offensive rating, net rating, he's right up there in plus minus. Like, this team is just loaded offensively. And in about 3 or 4 weeks, they're going to get one of the best defensive players in the NBA back in Robert Williams, who was going to solidify what's been a little bit of a leaky defense in the first month and a half of the season. So, Howard, I'll ask you this. Celtics made the finals last year. You know, they were a crappy second half from going up 3-1 on Golden State in Game 4. But as you watch this team, are they better than the one we saw last season?
So I thought about this a number of different ways, but I think I'm just going to answer it this way. I think this is the easiest question you've ever asked me in our like pre-show rundown. Yeah, they're better than last season. And look, it's not showing up in the defense, which is 17th at the moment in defensive efficiency. But as you point out, their offense has been so just incredibly great, so incredibly efficient.
Howard, I was at the game on Sunday against the Wizards. That was like 46 minutes of garbage time, basically. Like, it really was. And the Wizards are not a bad team this year. But that was like 46 minutes of garbage time.
Yeah. No, not only that, the Wizards have been a fairly solid defensive team this year. In fact, are a little bit better than the Celtics on rating. But the Celtics still have the best net rating in the league by a large margin because the offense has been so overwhelmingly great. And the reason that I'm going to say yes, yes, easily to your question of are they better than the team that made the finals last season, one, Tatum has taken another step. I don't know if it's a leap or just a very large step or whatever. Like he's, you know, skipping steps on the Stairmaster and just like cranking that thing up. There's another level of his game right there. Smart in year two of being like the unconditional starting point guard and you know lead playmaker type. Obviously more settled into the role, more confident in the role. The addition of Brogdon makes them better. And then I'm just going to say, like, I'm going to assume for purposes of this discussion that Robert Williams III does come back in a couple weeks, does play as well as he did for them last year. And yes, an injury history, but let's assume he stays healthy. That whatever I just said they were in defense, 17th. Any reason to believe that they don't jump up into the top 10? I mean, they're only a couple of points per 100 possessions behind 10th place. So the Raptors have the 10th best mark in defensive efficiency at 110.6 per 100. The Celtics are at 112.2. I think Robert Williams might be worth a couple points a game, a couple points per 100 possessions, especially because of not just his presence and his shot blocking, but the versatility it then allows them in that front court rotation. And yeah, at that point, like the offense has taken a leap. Tatum's taken a leap. Added Brogdon, bringing a healthier Robert Williams. And on top of that, like this team started at the point where they left off in June as opposed to where they were the first couple months last season when they were treading water. So yeah, I think they are better than the team that made the finals last June. So I'll turn it around to you. Is them being better than the team that they were in June enough to make them better than the Bucks? Because that's really the only question that matters.
Yeah, you can make a decent argument, and a lot can change in the next 3 or 4 months, but like the Eastern Conference Finals could be the NBA Finals. And I think that's a fair argument to make at this point of the season. The Bucks, the Celtics squeaked by them without Chris Middleton in that series. Presumably Middleton's going to be healthy for a playoff series against Boston. I don't know. It's tough. It's going to be that's an absolute war between two elite teams. But the Celtics, to answer the basic question, are just, I don't know, like miles better might be a stretch given how good they were last year, but they're significantly better. I mean, I look at the organic improvements on this team. We talked about Tatum. He's taken a step forward. Jaylen Brown, his numbers in the second half of last season were really good, and I think that people kind of overlooked it in the totality of the numbers, but he's picked up right where he left off in the second half of last season and is playing great. Like, whenever Jason Tatum's out of the lineup, as he was on Sunday, Jaylen Brown just looks like Jason Tatum. They gave, what, 36 in the game against Washington? Just a monster game. Smart continues to grow into that role, and Horford, was it like a year and a half ago where like Al Horford's done? Like, yeah, he's in Oklahoma City. He's lost in the wilderness. Like, he's, you know, this contract's an albatross. I keep going back to the numbers, Howard. He's shooting high 40s from three. Like, what is that? Like, how is Al Horford making that many three-pointers? And he looks like a guy that can play three or four more years in the NBA. Then you look at the external improvements. The Brogdon addition has worked out amazingly well. Brogdon had a couple of injury issues early on, but when he's in the lineup, he's really good. And I'm going to include Sam Hauser in the external improvement. He was on the roster last year, but didn't get a lot of playing time. Spent the year mostly in Maine. Got injured at the end of last season, which I think cost him an opportunity to earn a role on that playoff team. But he's come in, and he is like the perfect floor-spacing guy to play off Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. I had one coach text me last night to say they're getting some like Jason Capono vibes off of Sam Hauser. Kyle Korver's another example of a guy he kind of plays like. He just spaces really well, and on those three-point shots, he's high 40s as well. He's almost automatic when he gets an open look out there. So they're just miles better. And when Williams comes back, like, he's going to fix any of their defensive problems. He is going to fix them by himself. Like, you look at the stats from January 1st on last year, and the Celtics didn't just have the best defense in the NBA. They had it by a country mile. And that was in large part because Robert Williams was the anchor and Marcus Smart was playing great defense on the perimeter. When Robert Williams is back in this rotation and able to play 30-plus minutes per game, they're going to go back to being one of the best defensive teams in the NBA. So if you combine... Like, it's not hard to envision this team, if you just compile the stats when Williams is back, being the number one offense in the NBA and the number one defense in the NBA. Like, I could see that coming together when Williams is back in the mix, when they have a 9-10-man rotation and are able to just bludgeon you offensively and lock you up defensively.
It's on the table. I mean, that's a large leap, but... It's definitely on the table, and we know that this team has that in their DNA in the first place. So I mean, it shouldn't be that big of a leap. And they were number one in defensive rating last season. So yeah, they can get there if they can do that and sustain the offensive efficiency. I mean, chances are, you know, the defense is going to improve markedly. The offense might come back a little bit toward the pack, but. They're definitely, you know, wherever it ends up, you don't have to be number one in both. You know, they will probably be top five in both, and being top five in both makes you.
I don't know how. I agree that maybe they're not putting up historically good offensive numbers, but like I look at that roster, and nobody is on that team so far is playing that far over their heads. You know what I mean? Like Tatum is capable of doing this all season long. Brown is capable of doing this all season long. Smart keeps getting better, and he's still in his late 20s. Hauser, I think, is going to be like this all year. I mean, I think this is the guy they're getting on this team, and how he plays again off of Tatum and Brown is remarkable. I think they're going to be able to sustain a lot of what they're doing offensively. I'll tell you one other thing, just to put a button on this. I've been wrong about a lot of things in my NBA analyst lifetime. I don't think I've been more wrong than my questioning Brad Stevens as a top basketball executive. Like, he in the last 2 years, he has just pushed right button after right button. From last year going out, again, getting Al Horford, committing to Marcus Smart as the team's lead guard, to this year. I mean, I guess getting Hauser last year as a two-way player and now him panning out, adding Brogdon to the mix. Like, every button Brad Stevens seems to push works for this team. And I was one of those guys, and we've talked about this before, who said, go get Sam Presti. What are you doing? Keep Brad Stevens as a coach. Go get Sam Presti. This team needed Brad Stevens and his vision in that front office. And it's worked out amazingly well. Like I don't know if he's going to win executive of the year. We don't vote for that, but he's right up there. If you include the Brogdon trade and if you kind of lump in Hauser joining this mix, he has made two massive additions to a team that was already a finals threat, championship threat. Yeah.
Now, I think bringing back Horford was probably the biggest move he made. And at one point in time, you would have said hiring Ime Udoka, which was Ime's first head coaching job, was the biggest move he made, or the most important, most impactful, or you know, top two along with the Horford thing. Udoka, obviously, we don't have to revisit that saga. But even with that, you know, even with the complications that have come in recent months, and Ime Udoka being suspended slash probably fired, they had Mazzulla waiting right there. Now, Mazzulla was already on the staff that predated, but that was Brad's staff as head coach, right? So, and then, you know, just look, as a quick addendum to this, if we're going to discuss the great moves they've made as an organization, this is still a team that Danny Ainge built, right? Like, Brad has done a great job in the last year plus of putting, you know, making the right moves around the edges, which are often the harder things to do. But it's Danny's fleecing of the Nets, getting them the picks that became Tatum and Brown that are really the backbone of all of this. So, you know, that's not to dismiss anything that Brad has done also, but Danny Ainge put the core of this team together, and it was waiting for that breakthrough moment.
And sometimes, Howard, though, you in coaching, like, you need to make a coaching tweak to a successful team to get them over the hump. I mean, I'm top of my head, I'm thinking about when Larry Brown replaced Rick Carlisle in Detroit. Like, Rick Carlisle, Hall of Fame coach, but that team, I think, needed Larry Brown. Like, Larry Brown brought something to the table that got that team to a championship level. Brad made some deals and brought in some guys that I'm not sure Danny would have. It's not a criticism, but, like, Danny was against giving up first-round draft picks in deals. I don't know that Danny would have attached a first to get off Kemba's contract and bring Al Horford back. I don't know that Danny would have been as aggressive to go get a guy like Sam Hauser, who's panned out there. I mean, Brad's been freewheeling first-round picks over the last couple of years in ways that Danny Ainge, you know, never did when he was running things in Boston. So I think you're right. Danny built the core of this roster, but I think adding Brad to the top of it has made them the team they are today, because he's done some things that have made a lot of sense for this franchise. All right, let's go out to Los Angeles and talk a little bit about your LA Clippers. Kawhi Leonard's played 5 games this season. The last few he's missed because of an ankle injury. The previous, I think, 12 he had missed because of recovery from his ACL injury. Now, Kawhi's come out and said publicly, like, you know, look, I knew this was going to be a 2-year process. I don't know, Howard. Like, when I, you know, when I see Kawhi miss this many games because of a ACL injury that happened, what was it now, a year and a half ago at this point, you know, the playoffs of 2021, I get concerned. And you start to think about, wow, I mean, like, could this Kawhi signing, which was hailed as, you know, one of the best in recent memory, they got Paul George along with it, could this be the kind of deal that ultimately sinks the Clippers, because they gave up a lot of first-round draft picks to go and get Paul George in that deal? And if Kawhi cannot get back to the player he once was, even in a weakened Western Conference, they're not going to beat anybody. They're just not the top teams, at least. So are we starting to get concerned both about Kawhi Leonard and the short and long-term future of the LA Clippers?
I'm definitely concerned about Kawhi Leonard. And, you know, look, if there's concern about Kawhi, then, you know, by definition, that's a massive concern for the Clippers, because they've got so much invested in him and Paul George. And yeah, I mean, look, I certainly, everybody would have thought after the year and a half of recovery from the ACL, and it can take a long time. Like, I do not diminish at all the difficulty in coming back from the ACL, and also the fact that when you come back from an ACL, you often are not yourself right away. And that takes some work, especially, you know, mid-career as Kawhi Leonard. Like, I don't doubt any of that. But I don't think anybody expected he was going to have played, like, what, 3-4 games a month, you know, 20 games into the season, and would still be dealing with other injuries, the knee itself, other stuff stemming from the knee, whatever it may be. The hope for the Clippers and the expectation of everybody else was that Kawhi Leonard was going to be a vital part of this team for this season. And he hasn't been so far. And the longer that this goes on, the more you wonder whether he's going to get back. And how much of it is physical versus mental? There's always been this strange element going back to his divorce with the Spurs, right? Where, you know, there was the whole disagreement about whether he could have played or not at times in his final season with the Spurs. And it led to the whole divide philosophically between him and the team about his care and about his readiness and about what he could or couldn't do, when he should play. And then he goes to Toronto and everybody kind of just goes, well, okay, they're doing this whole load management thing. But you know what? The Raptors are really smart about the way they deal with their players. And, oh, look, lo and behold, they got a championship out of it. So I guess this is fine. But you did not expect 3 years later that we would still be asking questions about whether Kawhi can play or not, and whether, you know, you never want to do this as an outsider, right? We do it, but we shouldn't. Questioning a guy's, you know, toughness and readiness and all these things, we don't know what's going on in their bodies. The team knows it. The player knows it. We know very little usually. But the longer a guy's out, the more games he's missing, the more you start to wonder, like, what exactly is going on? And if it's purely physical, well, that's possibly more alarming, because, you know, what if this means he's never going to get right? Quick rundown here, just so we can set the stakes for the Clippers here. It's not just about, oh, can they win a championship with Kawhi and Paul George? Obviously, that's the point of the exercise. But what they sent out to get Paul George, right? Kawhi, they signed as a free agent, but Kawhi says, I'm coming only if you trade for Paul George. The trade for Paul George cost them Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who's now looking like a possible MVP candidate.
Stud.
At minimum, an all-star and in the all-NBA conversation. Maybe I'm exaggerating a little on the MVP thing, but Shai looks amazing. Danilo Gallinari was the other significant player going out. But it was all the picks, right? And here's what they still owe the Thunder. It's a swap next June. Probably not a concern. The Thunder will have the higher pick, so the swap won't even happen. The Clippers will have their pick in June of 2023. 2024, the pick is OKC's outright. 2025 is another swap. That's where it gets interesting, because 2 years from now, almost 3 years from now, if the Clippers have eroded badly because Kawhi is no longer Kawhi, and they're sinking, and the Thunder are actually going to be good, by the way. Like, the Thunder is going to get Chet Holmgren to pair with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And they've got some interesting role guys like Josh Giddey, and they will add others. And they've got all those picks to use, not just the Clippers, but others. They will pivot at some point soon, the Thunder, to winning. In which case, the swap in 2025 could really cost the Clippers, because if the Clippers aren't good and the Thunder are, now the Thunder are swapping to get their pick. And then in 2026 is the final piece, another pick outright to the Thunder. So the Clippers, like, there are consequences to come here if they can't turn this thing around during the Paul George, Kawhi Leonard era, which, by the way, could end as soon as June of 2024 if either of them opt out. Now, they both have player options for the exact same $48.8 million. I think chances are they both opt in and are with the Clippers through 2024, through the end of 2024-25. But, man, what are they by then? I just don't know. And there's certainly a lot hanging in the balance here. As you know, Chris, my general position here is getting those two guys is a victory in itself. The Clippers changed the perception of them. I don't know where this goes. Certainly it'll be a disappointment if they can't get those guys healthy and make a couple of deep playoff runs. But it's too soon to call this thing a failure.
Yeah. Everybody would have done what the Clippers did back in 2019, which was to pursue and sign Kawhi Leonard, because every team that had a shot was after him, including the Lakers and among others. And done whatever it took to get Paul George. Because as great as Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has become, and the Clippers knew he was going to be really good. Like, he was good.
They were very high on him.
Yeah. You got to give up something to get something. In Oklahoma City, as has been well chronicled, they knew they had the Clippers over a barrel in that moment, and they used all the leverage that they could. So it goes without saying that everyone would have done what the Clippers did. And Kawhi Leonard, in his first 2 years, played pretty well before that injury in the 2021 playoffs. He put up some pretty good numbers. Like, if he had played more games, and, you know, he would have been right there in the MVP conversation. But this is a, you know, it's a danger zone right now for the Clippers, because, look, this recent injury to Kawhi is supposedly ankle-related, but there's no guarantee that he's going to get back to, like, some kind of schedule that allows him to play four out of every five games or four out of every six games. And that's problematic if you're the Clippers. I mean, the Raptors load managed Kawhi and it worked, but that was before this most recent and presumably, maybe not more serious, but as serious injury that he's been dealing with. And if Kawhi can't get back to being the guy that we're used to seeing, you know, at best, they're probably a first round and out playoff team. At worst, to your point, they're one that winds up in the lottery, winds up forking over a mid to high lottery pick to Oklahoma City. So in November, I'm not ready to completely smash that panic button right now on the Clippers. Give me till Christmas. Give me till early January. Let me see how Kawhi Leonard gets past this most recent injury and how many games he's able to play. They're extremely well coached. They've got a pretty good roster around him. But this is kind of like that like yellow alert stage, to use an old Star Trek reference. Like, this is kind of one of the points of the season where you're like, uh-oh, if we don't see something more from Kawhi, we've got to really start to panic about the future of this team.
My last thought on it is just this. You know, whatever happens over the next couple of years, I don't think I'll think differently of the Clippers in a negative way. I will still think that it was a huge victory for them as a franchise that was a laughingstock of the NBA for literally decades. To have gone and gotten two of the biggest stars in the NBA in 2019 was a success in and of itself. It changes the perception of the franchise. I think it makes it that much easier to get the next set of stars. They are now viewed legitimately as a destination, and they weren't before. That part, I think, is secure. Also, they're respected. That's a very smart organization. They do things the right way. They attract great talent in the front office and elsewhere, not just on the roster. What I do think is interesting to keep an eye on is how we're going to perceive Kawhi Leonard in his career when all is said and done. Because if it just keeps trending this direction, if he's never a significant, important player again, he will always be a two-time finals MVP, which is huge in itself. He will always be, he's already on that greatest 75 players list. I was among those who voted to put him on there. But we're going to think of him a little differently if the back end of his career is this, is a lot of injuries and load management and mysteries about what's really going on with him. He's already this impenetrable figure in the first place, a guy who doesn't say much and we don't get. I'm not saying it's going like the Dwight Howard direction, because his highest highs were way higher than Dwight Howard's, but it's kind of like that model of, like, by the time it's all said and done, you start to forget what was good because the last, you know, 7-8 years of Dwight Howard's career have been just so bizarre and tumultuous at times. I, like, again, it's an exaggerated analogy, but it almost is going to feel like two careers if it keeps going this way, where there was great Kawhi for about five and then whatever we're going to call this for the, you know, duration. Again, that's zipping way far in the future. We don't know where this is going. But I do think, you know, how we perceive the totality of Kawhi Leonard's career is also hanging in the balance here.
Yeah, I think you're talking about a guy that will be remembered as one of the great players of this generation. But if he can't get healthy, he'll miss out on the opportunity to be known as an all-time great, which I think he was on kind of the track for after San Antonio, the 1 year in Toronto, and with this team in LA that was built to win a championship, multiple championships, that may be something we look back on with Kawhi and wonder what could have been. Last thing, Howard, very weird season so far, where you've got like the Sacramento Kings in the middle of the playoff picture in the West. In the Eastern Conference, a team that figured to be prominently alongside Houston, Orlando, and others in the mix for Victor Wembanyama, Indiana is not. Indiana is 11-8 as we record this on Monday afternoon. They play the Lakers on Monday night. And the Pacers, they look pretty good. Tyrese Halliburton looks like an all-star this year. They're getting really good shooting from a lot of different players. So let me tee you up with this. The Pacers, if the season ended right now, they'd be the 4th seed in the Eastern Conference. Can the Pacers be a playoff team in the East?
Before I answer that, I just want to note that some of the weirdness of this season has become less weird. In other words, we have had some regression to the mean. So real quick, some of those hot starts we were all like, all a Twitter about a few weeks ago, the Jazz started 10-3. They've since gone 2-7. The Blazers started off 9-3. They've since gone 2-6. Remember when we were really excited about how the Spurs were defying all the tanking expectations when they were 5-2? They've since gone 1-13, have lost 8 straight, 3 of which are to the Lakers, of course. They have 1 win since October 30th. So there's that. In the next category down, not quite as dramatic, but still, Mavericks started off 8-5. They have since gone 1-5. They've lost 4 straight. We're all back to questioning whether Luka's got enough around him and has to do too much.
They hit the Bulls Kemba Walker Kemba Walker panic button this week. That's where they are.
Yes. Yes. They've now brought on Kemba Walker and his questionable knees. The Bulls started off 5-4. They've since gone 3-7. And then the Knicks, of course, started off 3-1. Everybody thought, here they are. The Brunson signing was the perfect thing to launch them, and they've since gone 6-10. On the other side of it, some slow starts where they've started to stabilize. Warriors started off 3-7, have since gone 8-3. The Lakers, of course, we covered. Still don't believe them. The Wolves started off 5-8. They've since gone 5-2. Heat started off 2-5. They've since gone 8-6. So they've kind of stabilized. The Nets started off 1-5. They've since gone 9-6. So like there's a little bit of things kind of moving toward where you thought they'd be as we hit the 20-game mark, the quarter mark of the season. On the Pacers, the fun part of this is when you ask me, Mannix, is this sustainable? If I just took this in a vacuum, I'd say, well, yeah, why not? Like, they're 10th overall in offensive efficiency, and they've got some really good offensive players. They're 16th in defense, which, okay, that's middle-of-the-pack defense. Can you sustain a middle-of-the-pack defense? Yeah, sure. Almost anybody should be able to do that if you've got at least a couple decent defenders. And they've got Miles Turner, one of the best shot blockers in the NBA, as their backbone. So, sure. They are 3rd in the NBA in three-pointers made, 14.6 per game. They're more middle-of-the-pack in three-point accuracy, but still, they're solid there. They've done all this despite Miles Turner missing 5 games. They went 2-3 without him. And then there's this. Miles Turner is on pace, and we can look at this through either prism. He's on pace for career highs in scoring at 18.2 points a game, rebounds 8.1, three-point percentage at 43%, by far his highest, thus giving him his best ever effective field goal percentage, 632. He's on pace for career high in free throw attempts at 5.4 per game and free throw accuracy at 829. So Turner's having a bust out season. The question there becomes, like, is this one of those things where, okay, he's just out of his skis a little bit and he'll come back. He'll regress to the mean a little bit. He's also had a long history of injury issues. But Turner's always had the talent. Just ask him. Like, he's the guy who said, give me the ball more. And he's not, it's not like he's increased his usage a ton. He's just been more efficient. He's just been better. So I think that is sustainable by Miles Turner if he stays healthy. Mathurin is legit. I had a scout in the preseason when we were doing our scouts takes who said, watch out for Mathurin as a sneaky rookie of the year contender. That scout was absolutely spot on. We know Buddy Hield's good. We know Tyrese Halliburton's legit. Like, they don't have a lot of depth. They could have some injuries that could wreck them because they don't have the depth. And then we don't know if they're really interested in winning this season. Like, we're still talking about, are they going to possibly flip Hield and Turner to the Lakers in the Westbrook plus 2 picks scenario if the Lakers ever decide to make a move as opposed to believing in the fool's gold of beating the Spurs a bunch of times. So there's a mouthful.
And if they did that, that would detonate their season because Hield and Turner and their three-point shooting has been a big reason why they're sitting where they're sitting right now. But this roster is currently constructed. It has the look of a playoff team. And you mentioned the three-point shooting. That's the biggest difference this year. If you look at the numbers from last year, they were like 30th in the NBA in three-pointers made, like 29th in attempts or flip those around. Like they were at the bottom of the NBA in three-point shooting. This year, they're in the top 3, as you mentioned, in threes attempted and made. Nearly 40% of Indiana's points this season have come off threes. So they're just jacking them up and having success this season with some pretty good three-point shooters. They're playing a lot faster. I think that's a big key to their success this year, too. I mean, Halliburton has been instrumental in that, but they're getting up and down and playing with a pace that we didn't see last season, which has helped them get, I think, a lot of easy opportunities. The diversity of the offense has been a big key for them. They've got five players right now averaging double figures. You mentioned Mathurin, who looks like the real deal in Indiana, a real rookie of the year contender. Halliburton, you know, this isn't a critique of Sacramento, who also got a good guy in Sabonis, but he looks like the player that a lot of people in Sacramento thought he was going to be. Leads the NBA in assists, a double-double machine right now. They're playing without Chris Duarte, who is a big part of what they do defensively. So when he comes back, that's going to add another option for Rick Carlisle in that rotation. I guess, like, if I'm wondering about anything with Indiana, it's can this three-point shooting keep up, even with the current roster? Because we saw on Sunday against the Clippers, I was watching the parts of that game, their shooting went cold. And if they're not making outside shots, they're dead. Like, they don't do enough inside to make up for a bad shooting night on the outside. So when guys see their percentages dip from the perimeter, that's a team that's going to struggle to put up enough points to win games. But if they can shoot at Howard, they're a top 10 offense, they're a middle of the pack defense, that should be enough to get you at least into the play-in field in the Eastern Conference.
So I come back to this. What do the Pacers want? Like, what is their actual goal?
Well, isn't the irony to Howard that, like, this was the year they were allowed to tank? Like, Herb Simon, the owner, like, has been anti-tanking for the bulk of his time there. This was the year they were allowed to. They gave away Malcolm Brogdon for a first-round pick and a bunch of spare parts. Like, this was the year that Kevin Pritchard and that front office had authorization to just mail it in, and ironically, they're not doing it.
Well, and everything that we heard was that they were prepared to make the pull-the-plug move of Turner and Hield for Westbrook and the picks. And it's not like they were going to keep Westbrook, right? They're probably buying him out in that scenario. They're not. If they had made that deal, which the Pacers, by all indications, were ready to do, and it was the Lakers who did not want to, then we're having a very different discussion right now. Because they would have started off the season clearly in tank/rebuild-whatever mode. But because they still have those guys, and those guys are playing well, and because Halliburton has taken another leap with them, and because Mathurin's turned out to be a fantastic and NBA-ready rookie, we're having a different conversation. And because of that, like, there's a different world if the Lakers have been willing to make that move in the offseason. Now that the Pacers are good, now it's a harder decision. Because now you are actually pulling the plug on something good, something interesting, something worth getting excited about for your fans. And if you were pivoting to tank, let's remember, as much as we sometimes say certain teams should do it, you still only have the 14% chance of getting the top pick. So you may not get Wembanyama and you may not get Scoot Henderson. And, you know, it's supposed to be a solid draft, but like those are the two, like, guys who were looked at as franchise changers, and Wembanyama more than anybody. But that's a hard trade-off now. That's a hard trade-off. I don't, like, they're not going to be a top four team in April. We know that. They keep this together. They'll have a good season, a solid season. They're either low playoff to play-in team, probably earn them play-in, and they make, you know, if they make the playoffs, it's as a 7 or 8 seed. But still, it's a nice foundation to build on. Seems like good guys. You know, a team that Pacer fans can get behind. Not a market where you're going to go. You're not getting guys in free agency. Stars aren't coming there in free agency to Indianapolis. So there's a really strong case now to be made that even if the Lakers came calling tomorrow, like, I'm not saying you don't do it. Like, the allure of the Lakers' two future picks, when everybody expects the Lakers to be a disaster when those picks come due, and those picks then being theoretically high lottery picks, the allure of that is hard to pass up. But it's getting harder and harder for the Pacers.
Yeah, it is. And if they play better on this current road trip, it just makes it even more difficult. I am curious. Again, most people listening will be listening on Tuesday. How that Monday night game went with the Lakers. Like, you know, we're going to get like 60 from Hield and Turner in that one. That's going to be fascinating to watch. Howard, good stuff, man. We'll see you on Friday, and we will do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. lights. Brighten up your garage or workspaces with LED utility and panel light bulbs from GT Light. GT Light light bulbs are energy efficient, and with their easy adjustable light panels, you can direct light where you need it most. Save big on all GT industrial utility and panel light bulbs. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for more hot deals happening now. Save.